This is the Reformed Media Review. On today's episode, we speak about T. Desmond Alexander's From Eden to the New Jerusalem, Exploring God's Plan for Life on Earth, and we review the best books of 2008. All this and more ahead on the Reformed Media Review. Welcome to the Reformed Media Review. My name is Camden Busey. I have with me Jeff Waddington, who is teacher of the congregation at Calvary Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Ringgoes, New Jersey. We also have Nick Batzig, who's church planter. Where are you church planter at, Nick?
It's going to be in Richmond Hill, Georgia, right outside of Savannah.
Excellent. We got a change of scenery from Nick, and he's going to be Skyping in from a different location here in the future. But we're excited for you, Nick, and we're excited to see what the Lord's going to be doing in Georgia through you.
So, thanks, guys.
Yeah, Camden, we need to be praying for Nick, as he'll be facing his ordination trials within the next couple of weeks.
Yes. And pray for the presbytery, too.
Yes. Pray for the men of the presbytery as they examine him.
Uh-huh. That's a big deal. So we hope and pray that that goes well for you. We know you've been studying. So that's a little insight into what we're all up to. And it's a nice, cool January 2nd here in Philadelphia as we record. And this should be going out later today. We got a lot to talk about, and we know that we're a little bit late on our reviews. I put the Christ the Center highlight show out yesterday on the 1st, and today we're going to be talking about the best books of 2008. We're also going to be talking about a few new releases, but we'll get to that in a second. This is the Reformed Media Review, and Reformed applies to the reviewers, not to the materials being reviewed. But again, just as a reminder, if you'd like to subscribe to this, you can subscribe to this specifically, or if you would like to get this along with Christ the Center and all the other new things we're going to be doing in this new year, you can go subscribe to the Master Feed. But first, we have a great book, a new one that, Nick, you've really been enjoying. It's from T. Desmond Alexander and has just become available in the United States. It's titled From Eden to the New Jerusalem. Would you like to give us a little background about that?
Sure. Thanks, Camden. I ordered a copy from IVP UK probably about 2 months ago. I guess it's been out over there for maybe 2 or 3 months, and it looks like it's out in the States now. Our listeners could buy a copy from Amazon. But let me just give a background quick about T. Desmond Alexander for those that don't know. He is the director of Christian training at Union Theological College, and I think there's maybe a connection between Union Theological and Queen's University in Belfast, where he was formerly a professor of Semitic studies. The books that he write are – they're heavily biblical theological. He gets a lot of endorsements by men like Graham Goldsworthy, and focused a lot – a lot of his works are focused on the dwelling of God, sort of the G.K. Beale type themes. Obviously, the title From Eden to the New Jerusalem depicts that. This book is – I think it's valuable on many, many levels, and – It's rare that I read a book that I get really excited about, but I think first I'd say for the biblical theological insight, this book is phenomenal. If our listeners like Voss, if they like Beale, if they like Palmer Robertson, Fesco, any of the guys in the Reformed Presbyterian world that are big BT guys, Goldsworthy, who's not Presbyterian, but they'll really appreciate this book. Basically, what Alexander does is he looks, obviously, from Eden and the purpose of Eden, the dwelling of God on earth in the garden with Adam, and the purpose for which God created Adam to dwell with man, to have communion with man, kind of the stuff that anybody that has read, you know, through the Bible cover to cover would kind of get a grasp on, that's the theme, the dwelling of God with man, the fall, and then the restoration of God's presence. What makes this book so valuable is the way that Alexander kind of condenses these themes. He takes the idea of, you know, Eden to the tent of meeting, to the tabernacle, to the temple, deals with Jerusalem as the city of God, the place where he dwelt in the temple, in the most holy place. And he focuses on the biblical teaching of all these kind of progressive unfolding of God's his redemptive plan to restore ultimately in the new Jerusalem in heaven, where he'll dwell with his people and in his people for eternity. But he does it so well. He basically takes what Beale did in his book on the temple and some ideas he got from a book that he helped edit with Simon Gathercole, Heaven on Earth, I think it's called. And he condenses these in such a way that, I mean, I would give this book to any layperson, any office bearer. I mean, anybody in the church could benefit from this book. It's so well written and it's condensed in a way that you can just read through it very quickly. Another thing I just want to point out real quick is some of the new insights that I learned from this book that I thought were pretty interesting. If our listeners have read Beale's Mission of God, The Temple and the Mission of God, I think it's called.
Yeah. The Temple and the Church's Mission.
Thank you. The Temple and the Church's Mission. They would recognize the idea that Beale brings forth of the temple being seen in Jewish literature as a microcosm of the universe, and that many in Israel and even in the A&E saw worship areas as basically microcosms of the created universe. And I actually had a very hard time buying that when I read Beale's book. I wrestled with that, and I kind of thought he was relying maybe too much on Jewish sources and not enough on the text. But after reading this book, I actually think Alexander has convinced me that Beale is right in drawing those analogies or pointing out those that kind of relationship, because he points to all the scriptures, like in Job, in the book of Psalms, that talk about the pillars of the earth.
Mm.
And it really hit me. I never realized, because I always used to think, why does Job and the psalmist talk about the pillars of the earth? I mean, did they believe in some, like, you know, mythological understanding of the earth being upheld by, like, pillars? But what he points out is, no, that idea of the pillars that ultimately find, you know, expression in the temple itself with Joachim and Boaz, that even before that, that idea of the earth being upheld and it being God's dwelling place, like a temple, and then how that manifests itself in the temple. And he goes into some other details that are pretty convincing there. That was one really impressive part of his book, I thought. And that's in his chapter on Sacred Garden to Holy City. Then he goes into a discussion in his chapter Throne from the Throne, where he talks about God being king and, you know, God's universal sovereignty being set up without any opposition to it in the new heavens and the new earth, which most of our listeners would already know if they've read Hendrickson or, I mean, even just reading the book of Revelation alone. But another thing I didn't know, maybe you guys knew, is that in biblical scholarship, a lot of people viewed the Ark of the Covenant as the footstool of God's throne.
Yes,
have you guys heard that?
Yes, that's common.
Okay.
I learned it years ago, I guess.
Yeah, I had not heard that. And he explains how, and he uses some extra biblical material, but also just, again, the Psalms and the discussion of the dwelling place of God being his footstool, and the relationship between God dwelling in heaven and God manifesting his presence in the most holy place over the Ark of the Covenant, which, you know, is pretty basic stuff. I had just not heard about the footstool idea, which is pretty neat. And then he has a section on casting out the devil. So he kind of traces all the connected themes of Genesis and Revelation, God dealing with the devil, casting him out. And then he deals with the cross actually as the, you know, the center of everything. But then he has an interesting chapter, and I'll close with this. It's on, it's actually called Feasting from the Tree of Life. And why I thought this was interesting, I expected him just to go right into dealing with the Tree of Life and the significance of the Tree of Life in Genesis and Revelation, but he doesn't. He actually spends quite a bit of time dealing with the concept of holiness And this is what's so interesting about this book. Most biblical theological works don't have an experiential, practical, pastoral emphasis. But this chapter on God being holy and God wanting to make his people holy and the ways, the means he uses to produce that holiness in them, you know, following the death of Jesus, he has this chapter. He spends a lot of time dealing with holiness. And in here, and maybe you guys have heard this, he has dealt with in the book, he's dealt with the ideas of the most holy place, the outer court. So these levels of gradation of holiness, which I'm sure all our listeners have heard, and how, you know, the closer you get to God, the more holy you become because you're in the presence of the holy God. But then he kind of ties everything together from the book of Leviticus, which I had not ever heard before, speaking of three different ways to speak of men. The three categories he points out in Leviticus are holy, and then the second is clean or pure, and then the third is unclean and impure. And he says just like there's this level of gradation in the places where God dwells and the relationship of spatial, you know, sacred space, if I can use that term. He then goes on to talk about the gradation among men in the book of Leviticus ceremonially. Yeah.
You can even refine that even further. I forget the scholar, but they typically call that the holiness spectrum. And
right.
There's it's very fascinating to think about why, you know, certain people are allowed into the temple or into different parts of the temple and other people aren't in relation to their ethnicity, to their ceremonial
right.
cleanliness, etc. But it is exactly what you're talking about, closeness
right.
to God.
Even the camp, he points out, was set up that way.
Right.
Not just the tabernacle and then the temple, not just the people, or I guess you could say the camp and then the people, but the camp was set up that way. You had, you know, the tabernacle and then you had the camp itself, which would have been kind of like the clean area, and then outside the
right.
camp, obviously
uh-huh.
Hebrews picking up. But let me just read this one section, then I'll wrap it up. He says, with these main categories exist subdivisions. Differing degrees of holiness are evident within the priesthood and the laity. The high priest, for example, is distinguished from the other priests by his clothes, title, access to the Holy of Holies, and much stricter rules regarding marriage, purity, and mourning. Just below the priest in holiness are the Levites. While they are not permitted to offer sacrifices, they undertake other duties linked to the tabernacle, especially its transportation and erection. Whereas the priests and Levites have different degrees of holiness due to their ancestry and divine appointment, non-priestly Israelites are given the opportunity to enjoy a special holy status by becoming Nazarites. I'll stop there because for me, and I've read a lot of BT, but I feel like this book helped connect all these little details that maybe I had not connected before. So he'll go on to talk about just as the priests were used to cleanse, and Jesus, of course, healed and cleansed, then the Tree of Life comes for the healing of the nations and ultimately holiness in heaven and the relationship between holiness and the Tree of Life. But I just really want to recommend this book. I would give this book to anybody who wants to kind of be able to tie all the themes of God's dwelling with man together in a short, easy-to-read book. It is really phenomenal.
Hmm. And that, again, is T. Desmond Alexander's From Eden to the New Jerusalem. You can get from Amazon. I don't know if Westminster has it yet, but you can pick it up at least right now from Amazon.com. And that kind of concludes our new book section, and we want to move into top books of 2008. These come in no particular order. And if we have had an oversight and actually forget one, send us a comment because, we don't think this is comprehensive by any means.
Hey, Camden?
Yes, sir.
Camden. I had one that we didn't mention, and that would be the fourth volume of Herman Bavinck's Reform Dogmatics.
Yes, I did think about that. And also, did the essays come out now?
Yes, that's out as well, the companion volume of essays. If we can just for a minute, to mention that the volume 4 of Herman Bavinck's Reform Dogmatics came out this year, mm-hmm. Completing that set, a monumental work in its Dutch original. And now those who are not able to read the Dutch will benefit greatly. The Lord, I believe, will bless this work again to the life of the church. It's even though it's over 100 years old in terms of its original publication date in Dutch, it has a freshness about it. All four volumes, that is amazing. It is, in my opinion, the closest thing we have to the great, you know, Protestant or the Reformed Scholastic era. You know, someone like Turretin or Van Maastricht or men like that who were comprehensive. And this is an excellent set. And as you've already mentioned, there is a companion volume of essays on science, philosophy, and psychology and things like that, also published by Baker. That's a set you should read, and also that volume on the on salvation on the that was published by
Saved by Grace
Inherited Books. That ought to be Saved by Grace. That also ought to be looked at as well. That's a worthwhile volume. So we have, and also Eric Brisley's volume, a bibliography of Herman Bavinck. So we have a wealth of material by and about Herman Bavinck, and remember that Ron Gleason, who we've interviewed on this on the Christ the Center show, will be coming out, I believe, this year, 2009, with a biography of Herman Bavinck published by PNR.
Yes.
So we'll want to be on the lookout for that. The man amazes me. Yes, he was a sinner saved by grace like the rest of us, but God gifted him. And we only starve ourselves if we don't benefit from that. That's my opinion.
Yeah, it's been a big year for Bavinck, and that's a good thing for the church.
I think Bavinck's going to become a Bavinck's definitely going to become a an object of more scholarship.
He is, I suppose, comes pretty close to being a modern day church father, don't you think? That terminology has been used, Karl Barth, and of course we would choke at that. But I think Bavinck is pretty close to being that.
Well, I have no objections to that myself, but I've enjoyed everything I've read from Bavinck, and I would encourage people to go pick those volumes up. Volume 4, also the companion volume, Essays on Religion, Politics, I don't know, you'll find it. We'll put it in the link. Another book we've mentioned quite a bit this year was John Meather's biography of Cornelius Van Til. Van Til, Reformed apologist and churchman. We spoke with John Meather back in the Christ the Center episode a few months ago. In this book, we've talked about numerous occasions, excellent biography of a man we greatly admire. It had a lot of really interesting information in there that hasn't seen the light of day before. And he really did his homework and went through the Cornelius Van Til archives at Westminster, which we would expect him to do. But he draws a lot out, and he writes very well. And this is a really excellent book, an excellent biography, and a joy to read, even for those people who aren't Van Tilians, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I was it left me wanting more. It was just a fascinating volume.
That was another one of our top books of 08. I would also like to mention two that Jeff was involved in. He doesn't want to mention them himself, the humble man that he is. But the first, he co-edited Resurrection and Eschatology, which is a festschrift to Dr. Richard Gaffin. He co-edited that volume along with Lane Tipton. We've spoken about that on plenty of occasions as well. But that is a great book containing even a chapter by our other contributor, Jim Cassidy. But that book is great. It has a lot of good contributions that relate to the work and the contribution of Dr. Gaffin. And it even has several sermons in the back from pastors
That's right.
that have been trained by Dr. Gaffin and influenced by him. And that's another book you really want to pick up from PNR. Well, another book that Jeff was involved in was Reforming or Conforming, Post-Conservative Evangelicals and the Emerging Church, which is edited by Gary Johnson and Ron Gleason, both men whom we have spoken with on Christ the Center. And Jeff, would you give us a little background about that book?
This is a very good book, full of capable scholars. very often with these kinds of books, you there are weak links and strong links. I think every chapter is solid, except for mine. Mine is probably the weak link in the book. But you have chapters by John Bolt of Calvin Seminary, R. Scott Clark of Westminster West, our good friend Martin Downs over in Wales, who we've interviewed on the show, as well as Scott Clark and many others. Many of the guys in the book we have interviewed, and a few that we ought to at Christ the Center. But all dealing with this phenomenon known as post-conservative evangelicalism, which is more of a theological mood, and the emerging church, which is the ecclesiastical outcome in many instances of this theological mood of wanting to fudge on the truth question, the issue of whether, you know, the gospel, believing the gospel requires that we believe the Bible makes truth claims or propositions. There's more in the book than that, but that is a good the centerpiece, if you will, of the problem of the emerging church. And Jeff, so I would recommend that book, definitely.
What is Ron Gleason's chapter in there? Is it, it's on?
Oh, he's actually he's bringing to bear on the contemporary issue the insights of Herman Bovink.
Right. Okay. But so it has to do with community, right? And some of the vagueness of the use of the word community, which I thought he wrote a chapter in Reforming or Conforming that dealt with that.
I believe you're correct. I have to be honest, I have not read all the chapters. I'm still working through it. So we did talk with Ron about that particular chapter when we interviewed him at Christ the Center.
I think that was episode 37, if anyone's interested. But yeah, that's a great book. You can pick that up from Crossway, correct?
That's correct.
I think that's the first time I got that right. I usually get the publisher on that one wrong for some reason.
It is Crossway.
Another book that we have is R. Scott Clark's Recovering the Reformed Confession, an excellent book. It even has a chapter in there about recovering the second service, something that even Reformed churches haven't been doing lately. We've been losing that second service on the Lord's Day. Scott Clark's book, really good. Jeff, you've really mentioned that you really enjoyed this, in fact, that you wish you had written it.
Yeah, it's one of those. There's been a few books in my life that I read, and as I was reading it, I'd say, gee, this is so good. I wish I had written it myself. We have some differences, Dr. Clark and myself, on the significance of Jonathan Edwards. But I will tell you that the positive argument that he makes in the book cannot be gainsaid. Nor can it really be improved upon. I'll be saying more in a published review, so I don't want to give away everything, but that's definitely a book that people should read. You won't agree with everything that's said in it, but I think it'll get you to think about what it means to be reformed. It'll be a good antidote to the book by Roger, what's his name, Olson, on Reformed and Always Reforming, which is one of those post-conservative books that gets talked about in the Reforming or Conforming volume. And Scott Clark, anyway, that's an excellent book. It deals with the quest for illegitimate religious certainty, quirk, and choir, which is the quest for illegitimate religious experience. Again, I have some differences over his assessment of Jonathan Edwards, which you'll learn about when my review becomes published. But the book itself, the overall thrust of the book and the argument of the book, I think is perfectly sound. And ought to be pondered in all Reformed churches.
Jeff, we also wanted to mention two books from Tim Keller this year. The first being, I'll start the last chronologically, was The Prodigal God. We'll start with that. I thought that was a good book. It was not so much an exposition, but kind of, and it's an entire book on the parable of the prodigal son. And his point, and the title comes from the fact that he's presenting God as lavishly extravagant, generous, and accepting. That's how he defines the word prodigal. And so he mentions that the parable is not simply a parable about one person, the son. It's not even a parable about the son and the father, but also a parable about the older son, and he likens them to the Pharisees. It's a really interesting book. It's a really short read, but you can pick that up and hand that out to people as a gift. It's accessible. It's fairly easy to read, and it's a good book.
And, you know, Keller has almost single-handedly resurrected the, what I would say the accurate interpretation of that parable, because probably for most of us growing up, you know, when we heard that, we thought only about the son that ran away and squandered the father's livelihood. And, you know, here he focuses on both sons and the character of God the Father. And I forget if Keller deals with this, but I did hear Ferguson once. This is one of the most impacting things ever, was that he said there was a third son, the one telling the story, and he was going to the cross to make it possible for the father to receive the younger brother, which I thought was really powerful, the way he put that. And that might be, you know, Keller might have brought that out too.
I don't recall that being in there, and that's nonetheless.
Well, it's important to mention, only because the liberal preachers and scholars for years have pointed to the prodigal son,
sure, without any need of redemption or anything.
Right, without any need for atonement. So that's a useful reminder that the very person who tells the parable is the one who goes to the cross.
Amen.
That's right.
Amen.
So.
The second Tim Keller book we need to mention is the one that actually came out earlier in the year, Reasons for God. It's a book on apologetics. Jeff or Nick, you want to mention that one?
Again, I have a review forthcoming in print, so I don't want to go into too much detail. The book is elegantly written. Let's be honest. It's in the vein, I would think, of a C.S. Lewis in terms of the quality of the writing. And, of course, that probably accounts for its popularity, is that it's a very understandable book. I don't think you have to worry about a lot of mental gymnastics in understanding this volume.
And Jeff, you wrote a review how long ago?
Well, back in April or March or April, I wrote the review. It'll probably be another 3 to 6 months before it sees the light of day.
Okay.
If you want to read a review that's similar, although a little more detailed than what I will have said, that's a future perfect, right? Will have said. Would be William Dennison's review of the book at the opc.org website. I think you have to go in and type in Reasons for God or William Dennison or Timothy Keller.
And actually, I just went in there, and there's another one by Brett McNeil on the website. If you go opc.org and hit book reviews, it's the first one that comes up.
That actually is the one that appeared in New Horizons in the print editions a couple of months ago, I think. So that's the other one I was going to refer to. They all basically are taking a similar line to my piece. Brett raises some issues that I did not raise, but I am in agreement with him. Issues of a failure to, on Dr. Keller's part, to stress the sinfulness of sin, I think, was one of the issues that Brett raised. But the issues where I complained most, I did speak positively to some of the things where I think Dr. Keller is right on track. But I was responding to people who think it's a presuppositional apologetic, which it is not, and it doesn't claim to be. So we want to be careful that when I'm saying this, I'm not criticizing him for something he claims to be doing.
No, and I actually think that Keller would have anticipated that, because I remember on Sean Michael Lucas's blog, he was promoting the book when it first came out, I guess last year, beginning of this year, and he and Keller actually wrote in because Lucas had said it reminded him a lot of Van Til, having gone to Westminster and studied Van Til. Right. And Keller said, well, I'm interested. I remember this quote. I'm interested to know how people think I differ with Van Til. And so it's interesting that it's almost like he's expecting because he knows he does differ.
Well, you know, I mean, the obvious area is he's not making any attempt to defend Reformed Christianity. In fact, it's and this is where the connection with C.S. Lewis beyond literary craft comes in. He's not even trying to defend what I would call Protestant Christianity. It's a mere Christianity or what you might call a classical Christianity. In other words, generic Christianity that Roman Catholic, Eastern Orthodox, and Protestants could embrace.
But he does have a chapter somewhere where he concedes in the middle or the end, right, where he says, well, I am writing this as a
Well, yes, he will grant that when he offers a positive discussion of what is the gospel, it's going to be the gospel is understood by Presbyterian or Reformed confessional types. However, when he's doing the defense or when he's on the critique, on the attack, if you will, he's not as concerned to be defending a coherent, cohesive, consistent Reformed perspective.
Right, and he said as much at Twin Lakes last year. He was interviewed, and I remember him saying, I wrote this for the Catholic on the street in New York, and my, you know, I'm not accurately reflecting exactly what he said, but, you know, his non-reformed, quote-unquote, Christian friends.
I would not be comfortable trying to do that myself.
Right, I would not.
But that's would definitely not be a presuppositional approach.
No,
right, exactly.
However, there are some very strong points. I think his conclusion to the book, where he draws upon Jonathan Edwards' view of the new heaven and the new earth, is a very solid part of the book, where he deconstructs criticisms or questions that the unbeliever has. Some of those are quite effective, although, again, not always as strong as could be. If you were asking for a final assessment, the book seems to be weak on what I would call the certainty of the faith.
Right. And, you know, Jeff, when I saw him at Penn, I heard him talk last year at University of Penn on it, and my thought was most of the arguments he used, at least publicly, and I know that doesn't reflect the book in its entirety, but they were sort of what we know as the leaky bucket arguments. Would you agree?
Yes, that's correct. In other words, it's been a while since I've read the book, but if he has several arguments that are not conclusive, and he will grant that. Okay, so again, we're not saying anything that he doesn't already know. The problem with the 10 leaky buckets argument approach, which we would call cumulative case approach,
right,
is that the parts together are no stronger than each of the individual parts with their leaks.
Right.
So that's
which destroys certainty, because somebody just has to come along with a stronger argument. And, you know, it was interesting at Penn, one guy stood up and he had mentioned his argument about the 20 aces. If you're dealt a hand with all these aces, how could that be unless it was providentially guided, and, you know, the numerical odds of that, and talking about the universe being so perfectly crafted, which of course we know the triune God did, but he's just using the argument apart from what scripture says. And a young guy stood up and he said, well, you know, Pastor Keller, all you've done is argued for the possibility of what you're arguing. And what if there are, you know, 20 universes in which that doesn't happen, alternate universes? Right. And he was like, yeah, I mean, good point. And I thought you just conceded your argument, though.
Well, I mean, it reminded me of an insight that Jonathan Edwards raised, and I think it was in his Miscellanies, semi-private notebook, where he said the problem of arguing to God from the creation is that creation includes evil. Mm. Therefore, there must be an evil God as well as a good God.
Mm. Wow! Yeah,
that's an interesting insight that Edwards came to. That, of course, goes into with Edwards. What was his apologetic? But the issue with this is Dr. Keller's book is that In some ways, some of the weaknesses are the result of his adopting Alvin Plantinga's warrantism approach.
Right.
Again, Plantinga has some really great things to offer to the Christian church. So, I mean, it's not a blanket criticism. It's just this probability approach to apologetics, which at the end of the day, you could ask, as you've already said, Nick, why accept this? You know, if I'm not obligated to believe in the self-contained ontological Trinity, to use the Dr. Van Til's language,
right?
Why should I be concerned?
Right, and at the same time, would you agree, Jeff, that if you took most of Keller's arguments, the rational sort of defenses, and you subjected them to Scripture and to a presuppositional approach, they can be very useful?
Yes, I was going to say, and that's one of the first half of my review is actually commending the strong arguments that Dr. Keller puts forth.
Right.
And saying, look, these could be strengthened within a presuppositional apologetic. So yes, there are the various chapters at the beginning, and the first half of the book is answering questions, and the second half is a commendation of the faith. So there, the two aspects of apologetics are there in the book, and right. And I don't want to be coming across as if the book has no value. However, I am concerned that it's looked upon as the be-all and end-all of the defense of the faith. It is not
right.
That at all.
And it would, on some level, it would be equivalent to some of Sproul's writings. A little bit different, but I mean,
Sproul's, in my opinion, Sproul does a better. Sproul's doesn't argue. I mean, Sproul understands the importance of certainty.
Right.
And maybe we can close with this, and that is that basically, if there's one criticism apart from the presuppositional, the non-presuppositional nature of the apologetic, is that it settles for it appears to me as if Dr. Keller has bought into some of the a very perhaps loose or weak form of postmodern thinking.
Right.
And I personally just don't buy it, so I'm not going to be very at the end of the day, I'm not going to find that kind of argument that accepts certain postmodern premises. You know, you have your little story, I have my little story, and let's see if we can get them, you know, to come into contact with one another.
Right.
That's not a good defense of Christianity at the end mm-hmm. of the day.
Well, speaking of defenses of Christianity, 2008 also saw the fourth edition of The Defense of the Faith by Cornelius Van Til, this volume edited by Scott Oliphant, and he added quite a few helpful footnotes and explanations along with this expanded edition of the book, actually in its original form. This is in a series of reissues of Van Til's works by PNR, and a very helpful volume, even beyond the previous editions, some extra material that is going to help the reader very much. Kind of like a little bit like the Bonson volume, in that it's helpful to read the footnotes, and you get a little background on each thinker. As Van Til brings him up, Dr. Oliphant will give you just, you know, a three-sentence bio, his basic thesis. He also gives you some insight into some of the controversies. And if you just picked up Defense of the Faith without these footnotes, you might, and if you're not really familiar with Van Til and his interactions with other scholars, you might not pick up on that stuff right away. So it's really helpful.
Yeah, the return of the original, what is it, like one-third of the book,
yeah.
100 pages, I think. Really, I can't understand why it was removed. It's so helpful in terms of clarifying for the reader what Van Til's apologetic was all about, you know, the issue of common grace and so forth. Was Van Til an idealist? Those kinds of things would be settled by the reading of this edition,
the fourth edition
of The Defense of the Faith.
And
go ahead.
Doesn't Oliphant, in his footnotes, doesn't he explain some things like univocal and
He clarifies some of that stuff. Concrete, yes, universal, those terms, those idealist terms that Van Til was fond of using.
That's why it's useful. Is it's as you said, Nick, it's in, or Camden, you said that it was in some ways similar to the Bonson book. You're right. This is all the good things about the Bonson volume are being the method, right? The method of a clear explanation is being embodied in these three volumes, and the most recent being The Defense of the Faith. Mm-hmm. Previous volumes being Introduction to Systematic Theology and Christian Apologetics.
Right, both edited by Bill Edgar at Westminster.
Right. Right.
We asked Dr. Oliphant if PNR is looking at doing other volumes. He said not in writing yet, but he has some aspirations of doing a few others in this series. So we hope that happens. If PNR is listening, we would love to buy those books.
Yes.
If you want to put them out. But if not, you can still get them. They're just not as attractive sets. Those Korean photolitho printed versions are not the best to read. And they don't look as good on the shelf. So, one of my dreams would be a really nice hardback set. You could buy the whole works of Van Til and
hardback. We've discussed that, and who knows where that might lead. It may happen. It may not.
I'd pay a premium for it. Well, I'm just saying.
All right, you heard that, Bryce Craig at PNR. You heard that,
right?
Well, person.
Moving on, we did have another great book that we interviewed the author on, John Fesco, The Reformed Doctrine of Justification. It was a great book, and he treats the issue. We had a really good discussion with him when he was on. Jeff, how would you describe his particular formulation?
John is a friend and a fellow minister in the OPC, and I generally find his work overall to be very helpful and solid, and I would commend the reading of this book. One of the benefits is that John, in my opinion, brings the strength of the Reformed Scholastic and the Vossian and Geffinian biblical theology together in a wonderful synthesis. In other words, he brings together a concern for the Historia Salutis as well as the Ordo Salutis in discussing the doctrine of justification. Mm-hmm. Very useful volume. The biblical theological and the systematic theological and the historical theological are brought together. This will be a common theme in John's work as you see various books of his coming into publication. So if you look at the volume on justification, the methodology, where you've got church history or historical theology, biblical theology, and systematic theology purposefully being brought together, this is a strength in John's book. He has other books in the work where you'll see a similar approach to a particular topic. And I commend his work. You've seen similar excellent work done in Last Things First, which was on the first three chapters of Genesis. So it's a must read. Where I do differ with him again, as I do with Scott Clark, is on the assessment of Jonathan Edwards. John builds upon work that's less than convincing to me and to others who are students of Jonathan Edwards. And Edwards John questions whether Edwards undermined his doctrine of justification by basically arguing for a justification based upon the work of the Holy Spirit in the life of the believer. That, I believe, is a misreading of Jonathan Edwards.
Right.
And John and I have talked about this. I don't know that I've been able to convince him, but that does not vitiate, by the way, that does not vitiate the value of the book. There is some,
and
I think, lack. Yeah, go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say a lot of that's based, you've said, you think, on George Hunzinger's article.
Right? There's a lot of what John does is based upon George Hunzinger's work. Hunzinger is a Bart scholar, and I will go on record publicly and say that's where he should stick. He should stay to that field and not venture into Edwards. Of course, I won't promise to not say something about Bart, so I guess that might be a double standard. But George Hunzinger published an article in the Westminster Journal, I think the issue before my article on Edwards and justification appeared, and then a shortened form of it appeared in Modern Reformation. It was bad in the long form. It was terrible in the short form. Nobody ought to be building their work off of Hunsinger study. It's just bad. But there is at some point in the future a review of John's book where I go into some detail about Hunsinger's work. You can read that when it comes out. Still, apart from that, a very solid book. The only other criticism would be there was some lack of clarity on the relationship of justification to union with Christ. Still a good book, worth the investment of money and time reading it. And I would encourage our listeners to be on the lookout for future work by John Fesco.
Well, we have several books I just want to mention as top books or books worth books of note of 2008. For the sake of time, maybe we won't go into detail. And I know several of these we haven't done in-depth reading upon. But I do want to mention Steve Nichols' Jesus Made in America. We have an episode of Christ the Center. I believe it was number 48 devoted to that book. Great little book. Also, Concise Reformed Dogmatics, which we've spoken about on this very program before.
Yes.
That is by J. Van Genderen and W. H. Vellema.
And, you know, I just want to say real quick, Camden, that is an outstanding
book. It is.
Book.
And we hope to have James Dalzell's planning to give us a more in-depth review in the future on the Reformed Media Review. And we look forward to that. But for the time being, if you'd like to pick that up, you can get it from Westminster at a really good price. Michael Horton's Christless Christianity. And the folks over at the White Horse Inn have been devoted 2008 to that topic. And if you would like to read more, you can pick the book up, and you want to hear more content or listen to things on that theme, you can listen to the White Horse Inn, more recent ones. G.K. Beale's The Erosion of Inerrancy in Evangelicalism, something that we are very interested in, we've spoken about before, and we're planning to interview Dr. Beale about that book in the future. Reformed Confessions of the 16th and 17th Centuries. Do you guys want to talk about that briefly? I don't believe we've given much attention to that. We've just
that, it's a fine. It's volume one of what will be three volumes of that doctor, not doctor, I guess, Professor James Dennison of Northwest Theological Seminary has done a yeoman service in bringing these all of these Reformed confessions into English. If I remember correctly, and Dr. Scott Clark can correct me, but I think he said at the height of the Reformed, the growth of the Reformed Church in the 15 and 1600s, that the confession was written every, 6 years? It may be even more frequently than that. And so you'll see a lot of these confessions for the first time in English, or for the first time gathered together between the pages of, three books, I guess. Right? When it's finally done, it'll be three volumes. Right now, the first volume is available with a nice little introduction. And each confession has a brief historical contextual introduction that Professor Dennison has provided. So I would encourage people. Definitely, I think every church should have a copy of this set just to see the breadth of and agreement between the various Reformed confessions.
I just got a copy of that for Christmas as a gift, and I'm looking forward to reading some of those. But it's a really good one. It's a cloth-bound from Reformation Heritage Books. Really good book. Pick that up, and that's one you can have on the shelf and read. You can compare different confessions. It's nice the way it's laid out, and you don't have to read it front to back. In fact, it might be very difficult to read it front to back.
Right. It's a reference work.
Sure.
It's not meant to be read, from front to back.
No.
Like a regular novel or book. Now, the other we should mention in that a volume that has not come out that's not in the same set, but it is by the same publisher, and that's Scott Clark's classic Reformed text. Is that the right designation? The first volume is due out soon, and it's William Ames on the Christian Catechism. I may be getting the exact title wrong there, but that will be a new series of volumes that Dr. Clark is the general editor of.
Right.
Worth looking at. And I've said this before, and I'll say it again, that if we want to make a creative contribution to the development of Reformed Orthodoxy, a Reformed Confessional Orthodoxy, we've got to know where we've come from in order to be able to offer any critique or improvements to the tradition.
Right.
We need to know the tradition before we can do that.
Speaking of tradition, 2009 is going to be the quincentenary of John Calvin, of his birth, and the Calvin 500 series has produced several books, two of this year, and Jeff, you'd mentioned that there's several more to come.
Yeah, there's nine altogether, so seven more.
The two that are out now, The Theological Guide to Calvin's Institutes and also The Legacy of John Calvin, by David Hall, Dr. Lilback, Pete Lilback, had also edited The Theological Guide. But those are two great books as well. And if the rest of them are going to be like those two, then I'm really looking forward to them.
And for future reference, Dr. Godfrey has the book on Calvin coming out this year through Crossway Publishers.
Okay.
So you want to be on the lookout for that.
Do you know exactly what that is about in Calvin, Jeff?
I believe it's a generic introduction to him.
Okay.
Beyond that, I do not know the details. But you can go to the Crossway website, and it's listed as in the forthcoming books section.
Okay.
There are other, by the way, Herman Seldersluis, I may be mispronouncing his last name, has a book on Calvin coming out as well. I think it's either Erdmann's or it could be Baker, one of the major publishers. So be on the lookout for lots of books this year on Calvin because it's the 500th anniversary of his birth.
Mm. What were some of the other volumes coming out? You mentioned they're going to be publishing
Yes, I'm sorry. There's one on church and state, Calvin's influence on the understanding of the relationship of church and state. I believe that's going to be David Hall's book. Then there's going to be a volume dedicated to the sermons and lectures, I believe, at the upcoming conference in Geneva this summer.
Right.
So that will be – plus several others off the top of my – you can go to the Calvin 500 blog, and I believe they will list for you the remaining volumes that have yet to come out.
We also have, rounding out our books of 2000, a book on Calvin's sermons on the Nativity entitled Songs of the Nativity, Selected Sermons on Luke 1 and 2. Nick, did you want to mention this one?
Well, I think it just came out. Banner of Truth published it. I believe they're the first time they're in English, or
that's
maybe
correct.
It's the first time in a long time it's been in publication, but they are really good. I got a copy, and Anna and I read through one or two of the sermons around Christmas, and just a really great, you know, Calvin's experiential and biblical and pastoral emphasis tied to these birth narratives. So it is well worth getting. All our listeners should go out and get a copy.
Yeah, any of Calvin's sermons are going to be worth reading. Phenomenal preacher.
Absolutely. Then just rounding out our episode today, we wanted to mention a few volumes in the Reformed Expository Commentary set. What came out this year in 08 in that set?
Oh, goodness. But the most recent volumes would be The Incarnation and the Gospels,
yes,
which was Dan Doriani, Phil Ryken, and Rick Phillips. And the Doriani does Matthew, Ryken does Luke, and Rick Phillips does John. And they're all dealing, obviously, with the birth narratives and the incarnation. Those are all chapter. This is a topical volume, so it's different from the rest of the series. And those chapters, and there's, I believe, three chapters for each of the three Gospels, are actually taken from the commentaries on the particular Gospels. And that book also includes some interesting material on, helps for doing an Advent service if your church observes Advent. Also, stories behind some of the traditions of Christmas time. So that's a very helpful volume. Go ahead, Nick.
And it also includes hymns by, I believe, Eric Alexander.
Yes,
Boyce,
thank you. Derek Thomas, Boyce,
Paul,
Phil Reichen.
Paul Jones wrote the scores too. And I think the appendices, appendices to these books.
appendices.
That make it worth the while. The things Jeff just mentioned make this book. The Advent readings are basically liturgical outlines from Second Presbyterian where Rick Phillips is. And, I mean, it's just a great help for pastors, even if you don't observe an Advent in your church. It's a great help, and it's a great book to have.
Right. And the other, the Matthew commentaries, which are two volumes, came out shortly after the Incarnation volume. So you get the flavor in the Incarnation volume and then the full course meal in the two volumes of Matthew. That whole set is a combination of being confessionally Orthodox Reformed, biblical, theological, and pastoral. So for those out there who think that you can't bring the theological or the systematic, the biblical, theological, and the pastoral together, you need to read these volumes, and you'll be enlightened on that possibility.
And I don't know if it's going to be too late by the time this talk is posted, but Westminster Bookstore, WTSBooks.com, they were having a huge sale if you wanted to buy the whole set of the Reformed Expository series, which is about 9 volumes, I'm guessing. I don't know.
Yeah, it's the whole set. It's nowhere near complete. It's only been around for 2 or 3 years, so it's still in its infancy.
But it was a massive discount.
Yes, the volumes that are currently available, you can buy as a block purchase. I forget the amount, but
I think it's $145.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, it really was. It saved about $60, I think.
The only problem is if you already own a few.
That's right.
Then you can buy the set and give away some gifts, I guess.
There you go.
Well, this has been a wonderful review. We hope we didn't leave anything really important out. But again, this isn't comprehensive, but we've had a good time talking about these books in 08, and we look forward to what's coming out in 2009. If you'd like to get more information about us and our programs, you can visit reformedforum.org. You can see Christ the Center and subscribe to that. You can also, of course, subscribe to the Reformed Media Review if you haven't already, and get these things downloaded automatically to your computer each time they come out. And until then, we encourage you to read. We encourage you to listen.
Tolelege. Pick up and read.
We'll see you later.